Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Juan Cole, who is the subject of a front page story broken today by the New York Times, revealing through a CIA source involved that the Bush administration leaned on the agency to dig up dirt and discredit Juan Cole, an Arabic-speaking expert on Iraq, who was providing open source and accurate information the Bush administration didn't like about their war in Iraq. Then we will speak about the rise of Washington scandal culture, the subtitle of a book by investigative reporter Mark Feldstein. He joins us to discuss today's resignation of Congressman Anthony Weiner, whose recent activities have been feeding the scandal mill to an agonizing degree for Democrats, who are increasingly calling for his resignation. Since one of the few outspoken and combative progressive voices in Congress has now been silenced, we will examine whether the messenger has hurt the message. Then finally, we'll speak with the filmmaker of a new feature documentary, The Last Mountain, which opens in theaters across L.A. tomorrow. Bill Haney joins us to talk about his powerful and important film that exposes the lie of clean coal and reveals the best and worst of America. And I'm now joined by Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt Invading the Middle East and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And you are in Europe at the moment, but in today's New York Times, you are the subject of a front page story about how the White House leaned on the CIA to discredit you during the Iraq War. This, of course, has some very unpleasant echoes of what Nixon tried to do with Daniel Ellsberg. I thought the Watergate dirty tricks were over, but apparently not.
Yeah, it's a little bit of revelation about how things actually are done in Washington. And what's interesting to me is that it seemed like awfully big guns were being taken out for, you know, dealing with a blog. At least Ellsberg, you know, leaked classified documents, large numbers of them from the Pentagon. But all I did was comment on the day's news.
Well, apparently, I mean, I remember speaking with you at the time of the Iraq invasion, and you pointed out to me one of the bizarre things about Doug Feith's office at the Pentagon, who were in many ways running the war, at least that was, he was running the so-called Green Zone, and that they wouldn't hire people who spoke Arabic like yourself and studied Iraq because they were therefore subversive, or they didn't think they were pro-Israel or not. So it seemed to me I remember from back then, that there was an incredible kind of ideological blindness to this, to the Bush White House. Little wonder they got into such a mess in Iraq.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that was a matter of actual, you know, implementing policy on the ground, the Iraq war and invasion and trying to run Iraq in English. That was all their policy. But what's really remarkable about what Glenn Carl has revealed...
Now, Glenn Carl is the CIA officer who's gone public and spoken with James Risen of the New York Times.
That's right, who was himself ordered to dig up dirt on me and try to discredit my reputation. This is an intervention in American domestic discourse. I'm not even, you know, a professional politician. I'm just a Midwestern college professor who put up some thoughts from time to time on the web. So to have the might of the, a multi-billion-dollar government agency like the CIA trained on me is what's truly remarkable about this story, and it seems to me very unlikely that I would have been the only such target.
Well, what we know from Glenn Carl, from what he told James Risen of the New York Times, is that he was called into his office by his superior, David Lowe, in 2005, And what do you ask to, you know, what do we know about Juan Cole, and what could you find out that could discredit him? And apparently, Lowe also talked to other people in the agency. Other younger analysts were also tasked to look into you. Do you have any idea of is there a file or something? I mean, this sounds like a Freedom of Information request in the making, right?
They must have created a file on me, and you know, analysts were tasked to look into me. I don't know the details of what they did exactly, but I presume that they would have been interested to see my credit card records, for instance. I mean, if you were trying to find out if somebody had something to hide, then you'd want to look into the pattern of purchases and that sort of thing.
You mean, the Anthony Weiner factor?
Well, looking, I think Anthony did himself in.
Right. I wasn't suggesting there was any connection.
This is more like, you remember when Hillary Clinton asked that some of the UN ambassadors be put under surveillance and their credit card records be looked at and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So I recall, though, and the New York Times article didn't mention this, but I recall that you were up for a job at Yale at about this time, and that they wanted you, but somebody behind the scenes weighed in and prevented your appointment.
Yes, the sociology and history departments voted to hire me, and then it went to the higher Yale administration and was shot down. I, of course, am not in a position really to say anything at all about that process. It was behind closed doors, and I wasn't there, and I have no way of knowing what the considerations were or who made the decision and for what reason. However, as you say, that the Bush White House was ordering the CIA to try to destroy my reputation and damage my career does at least raise questions about whether they might not have intervened in the Yale appointment. But this is purely speculative on my part.
Well, the point is, though, Juan Cole, again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. He's the subject of a front-page article in today's New York Times, which reveals from a CIA source that the Bush White House tasked the CIA to dig up dirt on Juan to discredit him back in 2005. Now, prior to that, of course, I spoke to a handful of people who actually knew about Iraq prior to the Iraq invasion. And I think one of the few people in the entire media that was suggesting at the time that the Iraq war would be a quick victory followed by a slow defeat. Brent Scowcroft and others had tried to warn the White House of the strategic stupidity of taking out Saddam Hussein and therefore making the Iranian regime much stronger. And ultimately, Iran seems to be the winner of the Iraq war. But you early on were pointing out a lot of the folly. And I guess at the time that the White House asked the CIA to dig up dirt on you, 2005, that's when the insurgency that the Bush White House refused to believe was happening was really blindsiding them, right?
Yes, 2005 was remarkable for a number of developments. The pace of violence began to pick up. The Sunni-Shiite divide was strengthened. There were two parliamentary elections, which were won by Shiite parties close to Iran, an outcome that the Bush administration was very uncomfortable with and which I think it attempted to hide from the public. And a constitution was drafted and voted on in a national referendum, which the Sunni Arab population of Iraq completely rejected, pointing to a civil war that broke out in 2006, and which was extremely bloody, and from which Iraq has really never recovered. So I was simply reading the Arabic press in Iraq, talking to Iraqis, talking to people on the ground, and trying to inform the public as well as I could as to what I thought was actually going on in Iraq. And, of course, what I was saying was like night and day from what was coming out of the Pentagon and the White House. And I think that White House officials were disturbed that a competing narrative was gaining any traction with the public.
Well, I suppose the White House were successful, though, in they didn't discredit you because you were right and they were wrong. But it seems like the invitations that you were getting to speak before Washington think tanks and university forums started to dry up at about that time, right?
Yes. In the succeeding years, those invitations became rarer and rarer. And I think certainly, they set in motion whatever they could to blackball me. As you say, however, their initial goal of attempting to discredit me more generally seems to have foundered. Either wiser heads prevailed at the CIA and they backed off at some point, or they just didn't find a lot of the kind of dirt they were looking for.
Well, we know that the CIA were essentially harassed by Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby. We know that from the Valerie Plame affair. So isn't it reasonable to assume that this is a similar situation? And it's not a foregone conclusion that the CIA sort of snapped to, saluted, and obeyed. And they may not have been happy with it. And apparently the reason that the CIA officer came forward, Glenn Carl, is that he at the time thought this was outrageous.
Yes, Carl objected to the task he was given and refused to undertake it. He also went to his own superior, David Lowe's superior, in turn, and warned that this kind of thing could destroy the CIA. He was very concerned because it's a violation of the charter of the CIA. It's a violation of the post-Watergate congressional regulations on CIA activity. They're not allowed to spy on American citizens on American soil. So it was quite illegal, the request. But what's disturbing from Carl's account is that he represents some CIA officials as being perfectly willing to bow to the White House request. He ran later into evidence of further such attempts. So what's disturbing here is that there were people, I suppose they were brown-nosing, they were looking for promotions and so forth inside the CIA, who were willing to risk the health of the agency in order to make these White House officials happy.
And again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle East history, Middle Eastern history and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. He is also the subject of a front page article in today's New York Times about based on a CIA officer's report. He came forward to say that the White House back in 2005 tasked the CIA to dig up dirt on Juan Cole. And he's gone public through the James Risen of the New York Times. But do we know who in the White House was tasking the CIA to dig up dirt on you?
No, we don't know those details. This is why I think it's so important that the Senate Intelligence Committee, the House Intelligence Committee, Eric Holder at the Department of Justice, launch investigations into this matter. First of all, what was done was illegal. And second of all, it's likely that I was not the only such target. So we need to subpoena the documents. We need to know who exactly was involved because these were crimes. If crimes go undiscovered, unpunished, the likelihood is that they will multiply.
And what do you know, Juan Cole, about Glenn Carl's situation vis-a-vis the CIA? As you know, CIA officers sign all kinds of documents not to tell tales out of school, and if they write a memoir, it has to go through a censorship process. And we just had the situation with the NSA officer who was a whistleblower, and the Obama White House were all but trying to put this guy away for decades, but the case fell apart. So is this CIA guy in the clear in terms of being able to testify on your behalf, for example, at before a committee of inquiry of the House or the the intelligence committees tend to meet in camera. They don't usually have open hearings. But what do you know about him? And is the CIA, since he's obviously naming some superiors, and in particular David Lowe, is he going to get nailed?
Well, certainly he's taking a risk as a former CIA operative who's now retired. He will have signed non-disclosure agreements. I think he is somewhat protected by the fact that the material he's revealing points to criminality. That is to say, he's not revealing a classified program which was legitimate. He's not revealing something that would betray legitimate sources and techniques of the CIA. That's the kind of thing one promises not to reveal. He's revealing a crime, and a crime that is so heinous that, in fact, it's being denied by the people he's naming and by the CIA spokesman. So I'm not sure anything could be done to him for revealing this crime. And indeed, I think since he's been willing to talk on the record and be identified by the New York Times as the source of this story and to name names within the agency, yes, I expect that were the Senate and House Intelligence Committees to hold hearings, that that he would be willing to testify.
Well, I asked that, Juan Cole, because in the case of the NSA officer, he didn't reveal classified information either. He revealed an enormous amount of waste of taxpayer money on a boondoggle program, and his superiors went out after him. But more importantly, the Obama White House did too. So I'm just trying to get a sense of what climate we're in now in terms of speaking truth to power.
Oh, well, I agree with you that it's a very bad time for whistleblowers and that the Obama administration has behaved shamefully in this regard. In fact, in some ways has sought more penalties than the Bush administration had for these kinds of revelations. But we'll have to see. Glenn Carl is obviously a brave man, and he saw something happen that disturbed him a great deal, and he's come forward.
Well, I thank you for joining us. You are, of course, the man of the moment. you survived it, but it's got to be awfully irksome to know that the most powerful person in the world or his office put a target on your back and sought to discredit you. It's frankly...
It's disturbing personally. You know, it makes one wonder about all the people one's met and what their motives were. There's a psychological toll to it. But it disturbs me most of all for the health of American democracy. Our country was premised on members of the public having the right to speak openly and freely on matters of moment to the republic. And this activity is the most pernicious kind of undermining of the basic underpinnings of our democratic system.
I thank you so much for joining us, Juan Cole.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He is the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com, and he's the subject of a front page story in today's New York Times, where a CIA officer came forth saying that the Bush White House tasked the CIA to dig up dirt on Juan Cole. Let's now take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Anthony Weiner's resignation.
If you want to be a spy, then you must really see. And you must really see if you want to be a spy.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Mark Feldstein, who teaches media and public affairs at George Washington University and is the author of the new book, Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. For two decades, he was an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, and other news outlets. Thank you for joining us on Background Briefing, Mark Feldstein.
Delighted to be here, Ian.
And we just were talking with Juan Cole, who was genuinely a victim of the enormous abuse of power from the White House, reminiscent of Nixon going after Ellsberg psychiatrists and the plumbers, etc. But, of course, the other story of the day is Congressman Anthony Weiner's resignation. So I hate to lower the tone of the conversation, Mark, but as you well know, it is a major story. So I guess, what would you call it? This is from the sublime to the ridiculous?
Well, yes, and that's typical of the media age in which we live. I mean, here you have one story that's actually extraordinarily important about apparent CIA violations of the law, matters of substance, war and peace, and look how it's being drowned out by this sex scandal, in which apparently there wasn't even necessarily evidence of sex. Involving Anthony Weiner, not to defend what he did, God knows, but did it really deserve to suck all the oxygen out of the news landscape for the last week? I don't think so.
Well, obviously, that was why he was under relentless pressure from the Democrats to go away, because the media would not let up on this subject, and it was a headline after headline after headline, and I guess they were all squirming. But I don't understand the difference between Weiner and, for example, Senator Vitter down in Louisiana, the Republican, who got away with consorting with prostitutes and dressing in diapers and all this kind of stuff. And more importantly, I think Larry Craig, the Republican senator, who was caught in a men's toilet by the police soliciting male sex, and he talked about his wide stance and all this kind of nonsense. And I mean, to me, some people get away with it and some don't. So, do you have an explanation for that?
Well, there is no clear-cut explanation, and my book talks a lot about the history of scandal coverage in Washington. And the examples you cited, they were Democrats who fell and Republicans who survived, but that's not always the case. Barney Frank survived his gay prostitution scandal. So it's not strictly a matter of partisanship, although the Republicans do seem to be more cohesive and defend their own. Democrats tend to turn on them more. I think in Weiner's case, he compounded his problems by his outrageous on-camera lying. There was a visual aspect of the scandal that gave it legs, and he had already had a bunch of enemies within his own party, including Nancy Pelosi. So all those made it easier for him to fall in ways that, for example, didn't happen with Barney Frank. I think a lot also depends on what the news is at the time. If there's a big vacuum, these sex scandals tend to dominate. If there's more important news on, sometimes it gets less traction. Although the Juan Cole case is an example of the ridiculous dominating over the important. So there's no clear-cut standard, and the news media is a profit-making entity that has its ratings drop, titillates more and more to try to get its profits up, and I think that more than anything is what's driving it.
Well, there's no question that there's a difference between the way Congressman Anthony Weiner handled his, first of all, he stupidly lied and suggested that somehow his Twitter account got hacked, and he had some of the liberal stalwarts in the press defending him on MSNBC, he basically hung those people out to dry, frankly. Not that you can excuse them for sort of being that kind of blind loyalty. But I recall that Barney Frank, he didn't have one of those, mea culpa, tear jerk, Weiner was on the verge of tears, but it was a pretty maudlin display, and he stood up there for almost half an hour repenting and expiating in a kind of pathetic way, whereas Barney Frank, I thought, hung tough and was, you know, basically said, well, you know, this is who I am, take it or leave it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Frank's response was a steadier one, where Wiener's sort of vacillated from one extreme of outrageous denial and lying to, as you say, shirt-rending. But it was also a different media era, too, you know. I mean, and I think that may play some of it as well, that there wasn't the ubiquitous 24/7 cable, there wasn't the Internet, and the fact that back then anybody coming out of the closet at all, which, you know, Frank had done, but, you know, sort of almost confused homosexuality with the criminal prostitution aspect. There were no crimes committed, as far as anyone knows, with Anthony Wiener, but there was by Barney Frank. So, you know, that too gets back to, you know, sort of the earlier years before scandal culture, as I call it in my book, really sort of consumed Washington as media profits go down, their luridness in an attempt to make up for it goes up.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Feldstein, author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. He previously for two decades, was an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, and other news outlets. So the one thing, though, that I find disturbing, I mean, it wasn't just that Anthony Wiener hung out Rachel Maddow and those that defended him rather blindly and suggested his Twitter was hacked. And, of course, by extension, they made Andrew Breitbart look good, and his journalistic credentials and practices are pretty despicable. So that's one thing. But the thing that I find most disturbing is that there are very few Democrats who take on the Republicans, and the Republicans are being incredibly pugnacious and often scurrilously ugly by calling the president a Kenyan and a terrorist and not being an American, and they'll just make up anything, and they say it, you know, without any reservation, and occasionally a couple of feisty Democrats like Alan Grayson down in Florida and Anthony Wiener take to the floor and dish it out and give them give them back what they dish out, and so to the extent that he's gone and so is Grayson, I'm just wondering whether these kind of scandals also diminish and burnish the progressive politics that these people espouse. I mean, do you think it's?
Well, I think you put your finger on a very important part of this, which is you're right. There are very few Democrats who are as combative as Wiener was, and or is, I guess, still. Or I don't know. I guess we can talk about him in the past tense, even though he's not dead. Politically, maybe, but not, you know, biologically. And I think those people become lightning rods. You know, Eliot Spitzer was the same way. And, you know, we still don't, and again, you cannot defend what Eliot Spitzer did, but we still don't know, you know, who targeted Spitzer and how, what really was the genesis of that investigation, or for that matter, we don't know the full details of Wiener. And it seems quite probable to me that, you know, it was their very aggressiveness and unusual aggressiveness as combative Democrats that, you know, marked them for special attention. And the Republicans and the right are very good at hiring private investigators and catching them where they're weak. And both men fell, you know, because of their Achilles heels. And you know, you don't see that happening as much to the kind of more namby-pamby moderates within the Democratic Party, and there's probably a reason for that.
Well, there's no question, Mark Feldstein, that there was an organized campaign to go after President Clinton, and just as Anthony Wiener seems to have been a gift to Andrew Breitbart, it felt like, in many ways, President Clinton's behavior with Monica Lewinsky was a gift to Ken Starr and the witch hunters.
Well, that's right, and that case is amply documented because it reached such a incredible level of investigation. And in some senses, none of this is completely new. You, as I write about in my book, you can trace sex scandals being used as a way to neutralize your opponent all the way back to the framers of the Constitution. Alexander Hamilton, as I write about, was involved in a sex scandal in which he was blackmailed by a woman he was having an adulterous affair with, and in turn, in ways that may well have been set up by his political opponents. And in turn, same thing with Jefferson and his affair with his slave Sally Hemings. There is a history in this country of the opposition party finding ways to, use sex scandals as a weapon of political warfare. But it's gotten much more sophisticated now in this Twitter, internet instant era. The crimes are documentable, the surveillance abilities are greater, and the folly is greater, too, in terms of leaving a trail. It's got a distinguished past, but it's really, with warp speed taken on a kind of destructive force that wasn't known 200 years ago.
Well, I know that, Mark Feldstein, you've documented the subtitle of your book, Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. But my sense is that we've always kid ourselves about bipartisanship. Obama has been tried to be bipartisan. Look where it's got him. And one of the things that I found extraordinary is that going back to Watergate, Alex Butterfield happens to be an old friend of mine, the guy that finally dropped the dime on Nixon and revealed the taping system, which up until then it was only John Dean's word against all the president's men, and suddenly there was proof, and Nixon was toast. But what was interesting was that Alex apparently was the only guy that was in the Johnson White House before Nixon came in. When Nixon came into the White House, he made sure there was not one person from the previous administration. The building was literally empty. There wasn't a soul. There was not one holdover from the Johnson administration except Alex Butterfield, who slipped through the cracks. And guess what happened later when George H.W. Bush left the White House? The building was empty when Bill Clinton came in, except for one person, Linda Tripp. Go figure.
Well, I didn't know that. I do know that it was Lyndon Johnson who actually encouraged Nixon to tape record his conversations. Johnson had done that selectively, as had JFK. And Nixon was appalled at first and ordered the machines ripped out in 1969. But a couple years later, he changed his mind, decided it would be good to have a record because people would say one thing in his office, he felt, and another thing publicly. So in 1971, the tapes were recording devices were installed. But unlike Johnson, Nixon didn't control the on-off switch. He was so mechanically inept that he had difficulty doing that, and his aides put what was then state-of-the-art technology, voice-activated technology, and that, of course, was his undoing because it recorded everything, his felonies as well as his more noble moments. Ironically, it was actually Lyndon Johnson, in a strange way, who, not deliberately trying to set Nixon up, as far as we know, as Machiavellian as LBJ could be, but was just sharing with him some of the secrets of of the Oval Office. And that was yet another Democrat, the ultimate Johnson holdover, Johnson himself.
Well, Mark Feldstein, when you say Nixon was technically inept, I must say I'm reminded of Congressman Anthony Weiner's technical ineptitude, where he accidentally tweeted this picture. And that's what he said in his mea culpa, his endlessly maudlin mea culpa. He said, "I accidentally tweeted it, didn't mean to send it, and then suddenly I had to come up with a cover story, and that's how I came up with this cover story of it being hacked.
You know, with both Nixon and Wiener, you know, you can have the Freudian, you know, psychoanalysis from a distance and wonder, did they have some sort of, you know, suicide wish, some self-destructive impulses subconsciously that they weren't aware of.
Right. Well, and I guess you could extend that to Clinton and Lewinsky, too. That was pretty reckless behavior, given that they were so assiduously out to get him.
Well, that's true. Although, on the other hand, the thing you got to remember about Clinton is, you know, he was slicker than these other guys, and he'd been getting away with it for a long time. And, you know, I mean, there was testimony that came out during impeachment that, you know, he had had affairs with literally hundreds of women.
Sure.
So,
well, look,
Niles had always worked.
Right.
Little did he know that this one was going to, you know, actually save the dress with DNA evidence.
Right.
And
well,
had she not done that, that was like Nixon's tapes.
Right.
That was the smoking gun.
Well, again, I thank you for joining us here today, Mark Feldstein, again, author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture.
My pleasure, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Bye. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the director of a powerful new film, The Last Mountain.
People praying, don't you land on me, don't you bust my house, just let me be on my own ground. Well, they got the law and most of the land, but they ain't got us and where we stand. Let them hear you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Bill Haney, who is the writer, director, and producer of The Last Mountain, a new feature documentary about the costs of mountaintop removal coal mining. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Haney.
Thanks for having me, Ian. I'm glad to be here.
The idea that this area the size of Delaware has already disappeared. It's been erased. Mountaintops have been removed. The forests on top of them, the ancient hardwoods of oak, birch, maple, beech, ash, etc., they're all gone. The mountains end up down in what they call the hollows, the valleys, creating flooding. There's no, the trees aren't there to absorb the rain, so it floods down. And every day in these mountains, 4 million pounds of explosives echo through these mountains. This sounds like a war zone.
Well, I mean, I think that you're right, that the Last Mountain, which is about the fight for the last great mountain in central Appalachia between the mining company that wants to blow it up and the locals who want to build a wind farm instead and stop them, is an incredibly dramatic story, in part because it feels like you're in the middle of a battleground, you know, in the heartland of America. And the idea that the explosive power of a Hiroshima bomb is being dropped on the Purple Mountain's majesty every single week and obliterating communities and poisoning water and contaminating the air that their families rely on and so do ours is extraordinary, as is the heroism of the, you know, local waitress and former Marine and 93-year-old grandmother and college kids from around the country who are standing up to fight the most powerful interest in their state, the coal companies and the politicians they so generously fund.
And these are your characters, particularly Maria Gunno, whose house was flooded out in 2000. And she is a waitress turned activist who's leading the fight. Talk about the lines are being drawn here. On the, if we're talking about protagonist versus antagonist, the antagonist, of course, is Don Blankenship, the man who likes to adorn himself in patriotic garb. He, of course, came to our notice as the CEO of Massey Energy when the Upper Big Branch mine exploded, killing 29 workers, one of the deadliest mine accidents in the United States. However, he was rewarded with a $6.8 million pay raise after the accident, pushing his salary up to $17.8 million, not counting the deferred compensation package of $27.2 million. So the bad guys are making out like bandits.
Well, I mean, I think that our story, which is specifically about the fight for this mountain, implicitly about the fight for our energy future, but because, you know, these folks don't only know what they're against, but they know what they're for. They have a vision for their community and a vision for the rest of America that is inspiring, economically rewarding, and environmentally sound. But it's also, in a curious way, and kind of metaphorically, a battle about how democracy is going to work. And we've seen in the banking industry this notion that a small number of people take more and more risk, and if the risk pays off, they get paid $1 billion. And if the thing turns out to explode, we all get left holding the bag. And the same thing is happening in the coal industry. And it's happening, and you know, even more seriously than the financial disaster, it's poisoning our drinking water, it's contaminating our air. There are 247,000 American children born each year, newborns, that the National Academy of Sciences says are poisoned because of the burning of coal. There are 47,000 Americans who die prematurely every year because of the burning of coal, according to the National Academy of Sciences and the Center for Disease Control. And so the idea that what happens is you get these corporations who routinely violate the law. So Massey Coal, for example, in a six-year period of time, violated the law by their own reporting more than 60,000 times, endless environmental and safety violations, preside over, in this case, the largest mining disaster in 40 years, killing more Americans in a mining disaster than had been killed before in 40 years, and that the return for that is giant bonuses to the chief executive. It's sinful. And the fact that none of us know this is happening, I don't know how many of your listeners know that 50% of the power in the country comes from coal. It's several trillion pounds a year of coal are burned. Every freshwater fish in America has been poisoned. When you see those signs, you can't eat the fish because it's got mercury. That's from the burning of coal. The poisoning of our kids, the poisoning of our drinking water, all related to, in many cases, the burning of coal. And that what's happening is that they've contributed $1.5 billion over the last 10 years, $1.5 billion to politicians, and appear to at times skirt complying with the Clean Air and Clean Water Act while rewarding themselves, small numbers of them, extremely generously.
Well, one of the more, I thought, very effective sequences in the film is the Labor Day rally that Don Blankenship, the owner, former head of Massey Energy, he organizes his guys, his non-union workers, because that's what he's been doing over the years, buying up mines and closing them down to get rid of the union contracts and then rehiring non-union workers. And one of the other stars in the film is Bobby Kennedy Jr., who points out that he first traveled to West Virginia with his father, Bobby Kennedy, when there were 156,000 coal miners, and now there are fewer than 18,000. And this guy, Blankenship, at a Labor Day rally for his workers that he organizes, makes this speech about environmental extremists are endangering American labor. I mean, it's so unbelievably cynical. It's breathtaking.
It's the same in this kind of story time and time again is what's hollowing out our economy. I'm a bunch of irresponsible executives. So, for example, as you point out, in 1950, there was 151,000 miners in West Virginia. Now there's 10% of that, 15,000. It's dropped by 90%. And yet production's gone up 50%. How has this happened? And the answer is that when the CEOs go to Wall Street, they say to the bankers, we're going to use explosives and big piece of machinery to get rid of the jobs by blowing up the mountains and using the machinery to strip the coal out. So they've dropped the jobs so that they can get paid more profits. And then when they go down to West Virginia, what they say is those darn pesky environmentalists are causing us to eliminate the jobs. And we so very much wish they weren't. In 1950, the average CEO in the country got paid five times the wage of the average worker. Now the average CEO gets paid between 500 and 1,000 times the average worker. The unions have been, in the mining industry, for example, the unions have been largely busted, certainly in all mountaintop areas. And instead of a pretty good middle-income salary and benefits and safety standards enforced by the union, you've got people who are basically day workers getting $15 an hour, working underground in these highly dangerous places, oftentimes without a lot of safety controls, thus the explosions, with no defenses, and the chief executives are taking up tens of millions of dollars. And it's all being supported as if this is the free market. But in fact, these guys talk about the free market, but they never practice it. The free market would make them deal with the poisoned water they create or the poisoned air they create, or the black lung disasters that they create. But in fact, what happens is the rest of us deal with it. The federal government deals with that. And a new study from Harvard, a guy named Paul Epstein, suggests that there's $345 billion of health costs, the mining, transport, and burning of coal impose on America that's paid by the taxpayers and our families, while the profits go to a small number of executives.
Well, let me again remind the audience that I'm speaking with Bill Haney, who is the writer, director, and producer of the new feature documentary, The Last Mountain. And, of course, in this battle between the local people who recognize what's happening to them, because people around them are dying, their children are getting silicosis, they're literally, their environment around them is being destroyed, they recognize that you could actually get a lot more energy if you put wind farms on top of these mountain peaks that they're blowing up. But of course, the problem is once you blow the mountains down, there's nothing to put the wind farms on top of. I mean, it's an extraordinary cycle of destruction.
I think that you're right. I mean, these guys come into a community, they obliterate it, and 10 years later, there's nothing. But what's so exciting, you know, and in some ways so reminiscent of the best of America, at least to me. You know, I live in Boston, Massachusetts, and my house isn't very far from the North Bridge in Concord. And that's where a bunch of fag-tag farmers with single-bore musket-loaded guns took on the world superpower and created this country and changed the world. And it has been through American history, ordinary Americans who stood up, whether that was on the beaches in Normandy or on the bridge in Selma, and changed the country back to being a more full practice of the democracy we all hope for. And that's what's happening in West Virginia and Tennessee and Pennsylvania and Kentucky right now. Ordinary Americans, they're standing up and saying, we're not going to take this anymore. And despite the power of the politicians and these giant corporations and the security folks they employ, and dragged off in chains, I mean, the largest acts of civil disobedience in America since civil rights are happening right now in West Virginia. Four times as many people have been arrested in West Virginia than were arrested on the bridges in Selma. And they are beginning to fight back. And they're fighting back both for our democracy and for an energy future that is much more uplifting for all of us, because they're demonstrating the United States just as one example. The United States is the Saudi Arabia of wind. We have more wind resources than any country in the world. The wind in just four states, North Dakota, Montana, and Texas, is enough to power all the electricity for the United States if you shut off all the oil, all the natural gas, all the coal, and all the nuclear, even if every American drove an electric car. And even today, the wind industry employs more people than are employed as coal miners. And we could build a power grid to ship the electricity created by wind in those states around the country for $400 billion, which is the cost of 4 months of imported oil.
Well, the thing that Bill Haney, that what I got from your film, The Last Mountain, the new feature documentary, is this profoundly undemocratic situation where you've got two-thirds of the people in West Virginia against mountaintop removal, but yet you've got 12 senators in the pocket of the coal industry and almost every other public official in these states. So there's the disconnect. It's really about this national tragedy and a metaphor for the broader national tragedy in the United States, where the power of money is greater than the power of votes.
Well, I mean, I think you've captured the issue beautifully, Ian, and yet we've seen this before in America. In the Gilded Age, you know, when John D. Rockefeller ran Standard Oil like it was a private fiefdom, and the same thing was happening with the steel trusts and the sugar trusts and the coal trusts. In those days, they controlled state legislatures, and those folks chose the senators. So they really controlled things. And ultimately, the public had to take the democracy back. And that's what Teddy Roosevelt led the charge by the American public and passed the Sherman Antitrust Act and the Freedom Act and a set of legal changes that constrained corporations, because corporations are not supposed to be the end. They are the means. They are a tool to better the public welfare and health of Americans. And if they're not doing that, then they should be changed or abolished. And the government, forced by the electorate, has done that in the past and is going to have to do it in the future. And we've seen signs of it in the battle that you're talking about in West Virginia. So when the Bush administration went out and the Obama administration came in, the rules started to be enforced. And 80 mountaintops that were about to be blown up were stopped. And the biggest mine that had been permitted under the Bush administration, which was going to clearly and consistently violate the Clean Water Act, according to their own admission, was stopped. And mine safety standards began to be enforced, and Massey mines in Kentucky were shut down, and the new mine inspectors were created, and there is the beginnings now of beginning to enforce the law.
Well, you know, that by the way, that gives a lie to this idiotic notion on the left in this country, or on the far left, that there's no difference between Bush and Obama. I get infuriated.
On this issue, let me say categorically that Obama, while not perfect, has been a wild step forward, and Lisa Jackson, this extraordinary administrator at the EPA, has been a courageous voice for the public health and welfare of mothers and children and families all across this country, in particular in mine country. So, you know, I think that there's this idea which probably most of us would like to have, which is somehow we inherited this democracy and we don't really need to pay attention to it because, for goodness sake, you know, there's a baseball game on. I'd like that feeling myself. And it isn't going to work like that. If we want it to be the democracy we hope for our kids, we're going to have to fight for it. And the corporations, you know, they know what they want. Their legal obligation is to increase profits. They have no moral obligation. So the public is going to have to stand up. And when it does, it stands up and is counted. It wins. And the folks you describe, you know, in West Virginia, this bunch of people who didn't become activists because they trained to be or educated to be or grew up as rabble-rousers, they just lived in a community where their kids were being poisoned, and they went to their state legislature, and they got the door shut in their face, and they went to the governor, and they got arrested in chains and dragged out by the state troopers. And they finally started taking action, taking further action, getting arrested in acts of civil disobedience, going to see their senators, protesting in Washington, and they began to make change. And if we all do that, we can fight the corporations off. And if we don't, we're going to be in a fascist state, because if the definition of communism is where the government runs the corporations, the definition of fascism is where the corporations run the government, and we're beginning to veer dangerously close to that.
Right, and we have a presidential candidate who's a corporate man, Mitt Romney, who's completely corporate and who would, I think, if he were elected president, he just has that mindset. You know, he's not used to being a politician. He's used to being a CEO. He'd be the CEO of America. I couldn't agree with you more. By the way, I must say, the film, again, Bill Haney's new film, The Last Mountain, the feature documentary just out, Bobby Kennedy truly is a hero. I mean, there's a great scene where he rallies with these activists outside of the state capitol in West Virginia. And, of course, there's a counter-demonstration of angry miners organized by Massey Cole, who's given them the day off. And also a great scene with Bobby Kennedy in the local cafe with the president of the West Virginia Coal Association, the industry trade group, getting into a fairly energetic discussion.
Well, thank you. I mean, I agree with you about Bobby. And, you know, he's heroic because he does stuff for people who don't have a voice, and he asks for nothing for himself. I mean, if a hero is somebody who takes risks and makes sacrifices for the betterment of others, then Bobby Kennedy and a number of characters in our film certainly qualify. And in that sense, they're more exciting and engaging to watch than, you know, Thor in 3D. And
right, what the film points out, though, is the hollowness of the coal representative's argument when he tries to dismiss Bobby Kennedy as one of you guys from out of town trying to tell us how to run our state, when in fact the mine that is threatening the main hero's, Marie Gunner's house, is owned by a company out of Mumbai, India, ESA Energy. So,
well, we're becoming a banana republic. They're basically coming in, they're obliterating our landscape, they're poisoning our water, they're destroying our rivers, and they're repatriating the profits to India.
Wow, what a deal. Yeah. Well, listen, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us here today, Bill Haney. And again, Bill Haney is the director and writer and producer of the new feature documentary, The Last Mountain, which is playing at the Landmark Theater in West Hollywood and opens tomorrow at the Lemley Playhouse, 7 in Pasadena, the Lemley Town Center, 5 in Encino, and the Edwards University Town Center, 6 in Irvine. Thanks again, Bill Haney.
Thank you, Ian. What a pleasure to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And I would like to invite you to a free public forum at the Hammer Museum in Westwood next Wednesday night, June the 22nd, next Wednesday at 7 p.m. The topic is The Death of the Nuclear Renaissance. I'll be joined by Albert Carnesale, the Chancellor Emeritus of UCLA, Victor Galinsky, former Commissioner of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and nuclear physicist Arjan Makajani, head of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, to discuss the doubtful future of nuclear power. It's free to the public again. I hope you can make it next Wednesday, June the 22nd at 7 p.m. at the Hammer Forum. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available at ianmasters.com. I'll be back on Sunday at 11 a.m. with a background briefing. Bye for now.